Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Horton Foote's Texas roots influence a writing career that spanned more than six decades? Born and raised in tiny Wharton, Texas, Foote left home at 16 to pursue a career in theater. But the stories of family and neighbors from his hometown would feed his creativity for a lifetime and inspire unforgettable characters for the stage. Longtime friend and associate Robert Duvall, who won an Academy Award in Foote's screenplay Tender Mercies, spoke about the writer's legacy on this program in January of last year.
Perhaps now our greatest current writer, Horton Foote, who died 6 months ago. He has plays now in New York that, and one on Broadway last year that I think will elevate him above Tennessee Williams or Arthur Miller or any of them. He really came into his own the last 5 or 6 years. I think he's our premier playwright.
Author Wilborn Hampton joins us now to tell us more about Horton Foote. He is a theater critic for the New York Times and author of the 2009 biography Horton Foote, America's Storyteller. Hampton is in town to speak about the Texas playwright at the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live event this evening. Bill, welcome to Think.
Very nice to be here.
Why are Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller better known than Horton Foote?
Well, it's a question that that has come up several times, and I only address it briefly in the book. It's really hard to know. I think one of the reasons is that Foote never sought celebrity. He was never in the headlines in the gossip columns. He was married to one woman that he loved very deeply all of his life. He never had a string of affairs. He never drank anything stronger than Coca-Cola or iced tea. He never took drugs or did any of the things that so many of the other playwrights seemed to find their way into gossip columns. And he was also very very self-effacing himself. He had a very strong artistic sense about what he wanted in his plays, but he'd never really sought to promote himself very much. And he had a period of great celebrity in the 1950s as a he was sort of the golden boy of the golden age of television. Many of his first dramas were written for the multitude of drama shows that were on in the 1950s. He became quite a celebrity, and then he went into Eclipse in the late 60s and really had two careers, as it turned out, for the period of about 10 years in which almost nothing of his was done. But I agree with Duvall. I think that Horton Foote will probably, 100 years from now, when the 22nd century wants to look back at the 20th century, then it will be Horton's plays that are done more than probably any other American playwright of the 20th century.
You really can't understand Horton Foote without understanding the place he came from. Can you talk about what Wharton, Texas was like in 1916 when he was born?
Well, it was. It was a small little town. It was a town that was first incorporated very early on when it was added to a mail route in the early Republic of Texas. And then it became a state. It had a railroad line that came through it. But it was always a very small town. And often Foote is quite often compared to Chekhov, mm-hmm. sometimes to Faulkner as well. And Frank Rich, who was the chief drama critic at the New York Times, once said that his work was like a collaboration between Faulkner and Chekhov. And sometimes he's dismissed as simply a Texas writer or a regional writer or a writer of the rural South of the United States. But one has to remember that Chekhov is also a rural writer and a regional writer, and he wrote about small towns in provincial Russia. What sets Foote apart is that he takes the life of a small town in Texas and turns it into looks at the universal questions that everybody faces in every generation, whether it's in a large city or in a small town, whether to leave and to go seek fame and fortune and love in the big cities, whether to marry for money or to marry for love, whether to all these questions that come up from small towns can be translated into big cities, and they become universal themes that echo throughout. I remember once when I was at the University of Texas, and I had a professor tell me, he said, you know, the same things happened to the people in Paris, Texas, that happened in Paris, France. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the young undergraduate at the time, I simply sort of rolled my eyes and thought, well, this is crazy. But it was the plays of Horton Foote that convinced me of that, and it's true. It's true. The same things happen. And the universal dramas, the dramas that last, the dramas that endure, the plays that endure, the books that endure, are those that deal with the internal questions that face the same, that the people face in both big cities and in small towns.
And he also didn't get tangled up in that desire to be exceptionally avant-garde. He wasn't trying to sort of reinvent the form of theater.
No, not in the least. There was one period in his life, which was right after World War II, in the early 40s and through the war and immediately after the war, when there was a great movement in New York that the theater of the future was going to be a fusion of music and dance and the spoken word. And there were a lot of productions that would, many of the modern dance choreographers that Martha Graham, Agnes DeMille, people like that, Mildred Donnock, they all would create dances to poems or to stories. And Foote wrote some little one-act playlets, we would call them, for that. And some of the 20th century composers were beginning to cut their teeth with composing music for these. And he indulged in that for a few years. And he even went to Washington and so that because he thought the Broadway theater, the New York theater, was too commercial. And he stayed there for 3 or 4 years and decided that the experiment was over, that he wrote, he went back to writing what he knew, which was naturalistic plays, which had been his first plays before this period. But after that, it was no. He looked for what went on in the human heart and the conflict, the inner conflicts that everyone faces. And he always remained true to that, even in the long years from the late 60s, say 68 or 69, until about 78 or 79, when most producers, either in Hollywood or in New York, were looking for action, they were looking for sex, they were looking for what we call the 60s, which mostly took place in the 70s. But anyway, that whole movement of what we now call the 60s. But he would not bend to it, and he kept writing. And there were times when he felt he should just give up writing. And it was during this time, however, that he also had some very personal, it was one of the lowest points in his life personally. His mother and father died within a year of each other. And it was in going through their things that he began to imagine a possible trilogy, he first thought. And he started writing about their lives. But more to the point of your question, he would not abandon what he felt was the true drama that made the theater alive, and that was the drama that goes on within people's lives when they face adversity, when they face hardship, when they face difficulties, and how they face it. That was the real drama, and how they come through adversity and setbacks And, of course, that became the nine-play Orphan's Home cycle. It was also during that period, mentioning Bob Duvall, it's also during that period that he needed some money and decided to write an original screenplay. And he had the germ of an idea for a screenplay, and it was later called Tender Mercies and, of course, one of the great American movies.
I don't know if I was what you call rich, but I had a few dollars.
How'd you get it?
Writing songs.
How do you get money for that?
Yeah, people crazy enough to pay you for it, they do it.
What happened to your money?
I lost it.
How?
Too much Applejack.
You think you'll ever be rich again?
Well, I'll tell you what, Sonny, I don't lay awake nights worrying about it. No. Now, look, there's a D, right? D is in dog. Now, watch me. I'll call him out. I've decided to leave G here forever. Not really. Let me know if you're staying behind. It's A7. Otherwise, I'll be gone in the morning. D and O. Let me know if you're staying behind.
That was a clip from the 1983 film written by Horton Foote, Tender Mercies. We are speaking this hour with biographer Wilborn Hampton, whose book is called Horton Foote, America's Storyteller. How much work did he do with Duvall? There's sort of debate over whether the part was written specifically with Duvall in mind or not.
Well, it's very interesting. It's a wonderful clip. It's a very touching and moving scene, as a matter of fact. And Alan Hubbard, who plays the little boy and Duvall, became very close, as a matter of fact, on the set. And Duvall ended up teaching Hubbard how to play the guitar. Mm-hmm. And the friendship continued after the movie. And he ended up, as a matter of fact, giving Hubbard a guitar. And Hubbard went on in life and became a guitar teacher, as a matter of fact. It was it's very interesting. It began with an idea. Lucy Kroll, Foote's agent, told him that she thought he could get some money. He was in straits. He was running out of money if he did a treatment of an original screenplay. And so he did. His nephew down in Houston was putting together a little band, and his first idea was to write about four young men in Texas who were going to try to form a country and western band. So he did a treatment. He went to California, and he met with a producer there, and the producer liked it very much and said, well, you know, come back and have your agent come back in a week and we'll sign the contracts and get things moving. But he made a suggestion. He said, you might want to think about it creating an older character, an older country and western singer who the young boys look up to. And Foote liked that idea. He thought that was a brilliant idea. And so he began to think about the character that became Max Sledge. And so he went home and he was working on it very hard. And Lucy Kroll went to California. At the airport, when she arrived, she picked up a copy of the Hollywood Reporter and learned that this producer had been fired from the studio. And so the whole deal fell through. Mm-hmm. But Foote was always nothing if not optimistic. And he kept working. He began to like the movie, the screenplay, very much, and especially the character Max Sledge. He once said that he really liked Max Sledge, that Max Sledge was one of his favorite characters. And so he was writing it, and at the time, his daughter, Barbara Halley, who was the actress, had read it, and she said, Bob Duvall can sing. And in fact, Duvall had actually sang in the background in one of the earlier movies without credit, actually. And suddenly it came into mind, Horton said, oh, yeah. So he sort of began to think about Duvall as the character Max Sledge, and they sort of went together. He did not write the part specifically for Duvall, but after that suggestion from his daughter, he began to think of Duvall in terms. Then he finished the script and sent it to Duvall, who immediately fell in love with the script and the story and the screenplay and the character, and said, we want to do it immediately. Strangely enough, as it is, as I mentioned earlier, I think almost one of the great movies of the American cinema, as a matter of fact. He had trouble. It was nearly 3 years before they got it before the camera. He couldn't find backing. Finally, he found some backing. Then they couldn't find a director. And it was a great disappointment to Horton that many directors that he had worked with looked at it, and they all turned it down. And finally, Duvall had seen a movie that Bruce Beresford had made called Breaking Morant. And they sent the script to Beresford, and he agreed to do it.
My guest this hour is theater critic for the New York Times, Wilborn Hampton. He is also the author of the 2009 biography, Horton Foote, America's Storyteller. He's in town to speak to Arts and Letters Live tonight at 7:30 at the Dallas Museum of Art. There will also be actors from the current Dallas Theater Center production of Foote's Dividing the Estate at the event tonight. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and theater critic for the New York Times, Wilborn Hampton. His 2009 book is called Horton Foote, America's Storyteller. He'll speak tonight at Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. The event takes place at 7:30. It's called Horton Foote, Readings and Recollections, and will also feature actors from the Dallas Theater Center's production of Foote's Dividing the Estate. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Bill, Tender Mercies was shot for the, even in 1983, unbelievably cheap price, under $5 million.
Right.
Did it sort of kick off the independent movie movement?
Well, it was. It was one of the first. The big rush of indies in the 80s had obviously not arrived. And Foote and Duvall, who were very eager to get it before the cameras, were having trouble getting money. And they went from office to office and with their hat out. And nobody was really writing checks. But they finally did. EMI got behind it, and it ended up, of course, getting made. But the studios that was going to distribute it was very reluctant to. They didn't have much faith in it, and only opened it in three cities, actually, and New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. And it was several months before the Academy Awards. And now, of course, everybody tries to save their best picture for December so mm-hmm. they can get an Academy Award. But it still got, I think it was five nominations. It got several nominations. And, of course, Duvall won for Best Actor and Foote won for Best Screenplay. But it was a real struggle. It was nearly 3 years to get before the cameras. And obviously, it's, as I've said before, is this great motion picture, and it went back into it was shown again in theaters, but it was the studio had actually sold the rights to cable TV before the Academy Awards came out, and never really got behind the movie. But it started Foote thinking about independent movies, and in the early 80s, he and his wife Lillian decided to try to turn some of the Orphan's Home Cycle plays into movies, which they did, and several of them, two of them, I guess, and also were also shot here around in the Dallas area.
In Waxahachie, right?
You're right. Waxahachie mm-hmm. was sort of the base, and they used several little towns for scenes, external scenes. For the actual, for Tender Mercies, the actual motel and filling station that Rosa Lee ran were Max Sledge, the Duvall character, winds up drunk and penniless and having to work off his debt. They actually built from scratch, and it was so realistic that several times during the shooting, cars would pull into the filling station when they fell off, only to be told, look, this is a movie set. We don't really sell gas here.
You know, you talked earlier about Horton Foote's humility, and in fact, the first Academy Award that he won for the adaptation of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, he didn't even go to the ceremony because he was sure he wouldn't win.
He was absolutely certain he wouldn't win. He was very flattered to be nominated. Once again, it was a movie that the studio heads at the time thought was just too dull, too uninteresting, and they were only going to release it in art houses. And it was mainly through the influence of Gregory Peck, who was a top A-list Hollywood star, who insisted that it open at Radio City Music Hall and play in first-run houses. But he didn't. He stayed at home. He was certain that Lawrence of Arabia would probably win all the awards, and he was sitting at home in his pajamas with his family watching TV when Bette Davis suddenly announced that he was the winner and held the Oscar above her head and shouted, Horton Foote. Bette Davis was a big fan as well. But
how old were you when you got your first gun, Atkins?
13 or 14. I remember when my daddy gave me that gun. He told me that I should never point at anything in the house and that he'd rather I'd shoot at tin cans in the backyard. But he said that sooner or later, he supposed the temptation to go after birds would be too much. And that I could shoot all the blue jays I wanted, if I could hit them. But to remember, it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Why?
Well, I reckon because mockingbirds don't do anything but make music for us to enjoy. Don't need people's gardens. They'll nest in the corn cribs. They don't do one thing but just sing their hearts out for us.
That was Gregory Peck in Horton Foote's adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. My guest this hour is Foote's biographer, Wilborn Hampton. What do you think was Horton Foote's particular gift in adapting other people's work? Because it's one thing to write things that you have conceived yourself. It's another thing to get to the very best of someone else's work.
Well, Horton's great strength is to go to the heart and soul of a character. And he gets into the mind and the heart of so many of the characters. And he would only adapt those novels or stories that which he felt a great affinity, in which he felt he understood the characters. And he would get very interested in the people, the characters. And it's an interesting story about how he came to Mockingbird. The producer, when he was in California doing television a lot, he had met a producer and a director. Robert Mulligan had directed some of his works, producer Alan Pakula. And Pakula had obtained the rights to this first novel by a young writer by the name of Harper Lee. And he sent the book to Foote, who was then living in Nyack, New York. And Foote put it on the coffee table and forgot about it. He was working on something else. And Foote's wife, Lillian, sat down and read it. She read it all the way through. And she came up, and it was a rule of the house that no one, when the door was closed in the attic studio that Foote wrote, nobody would disturb him. However, she knocked on the door once and walked in. And Foote always respected his wife's literary taste. She was very much his soulmate as well. And she looked at him and she said, Horton, I think you better come down and read this book. He looked at her and he trusted her implicitly. He said, okay. And he went downstairs and he started to read the book. Read it in one sitting, called Pakula and said, I want to do the screenplay. Because he identified immediately with the young girl scout and her brother Jim and Atticus, the widower lawyer. And he just felt a great affinity. And the only hitch was is that Harper Lee did not want to do the screenplay herself, but she had refusal of, she could pick whoever was going to do the screenplay. She had refusal rights. And so Pakula said, why don't you ask her up for dinner? And as Horton used to tell the story, told me the story several times, she came up to Nyack for dinner, and he said as soon as she walked in the door, he knew that they were lifelong friends, and she felt the same. And so he became very involved, and it was the same thing happened with one of the Faulkner. He did a few Faulkner adaptations. One of them was for the movie. It was first a stage play, first a TV play, and then a stage play, and then a movie of a story called Tomorrow. And there, it's interesting. It's a very small Faulkner story, and it's about a backwoods man who takes in a pregnant woman who's run away from her abusive husband, and he lets her stay there until the child is born, and then she dies abruptly, and he takes care of the boy until the family comes and takes the boy away. But the woman is mentioned only like in one paragraph in Faulkner's story. And he suddenly had this whole germ of an idea about her. She didn't even have a name in the Faulkner story. He gave her a name, Sarah, and invented a whole backstory for her. And she becomes as much a part of the story as does the man, the backwoodsman who takes her in, which was played by Duvall in the movie, brilliantly. And Faulkner was so admiring of it that he wrote Foote and said that he wanted to share the copyright with him because of what he had done with expanding the character. But the point being, to your question, is that he gets involved with the characters. He feels that he gets to know them. And if he feels that affinity, then he feels that he can do justice to the original work.
And in a lot of his own work, he developed characters out of people that he actually did know or had grown up hearing about his entire life.
Absolutely, yeah. Part of the subtitle, The Storyteller, the whole inspiration for so much of his work came from stories that he heard as a child. And again, we go back to what comes out of a small town. And the same thing comes out of a small town that comes out of a big city, as I said before. But he heard all these stories. He heard about who killed whom and why. He heard about who stole and got caught, who stole and didn't get caught, about all the adulterers and philanderers and drunkards that occupy and inhabit a small town, and some of them involving his own family. He had three uncles who were all reprobates, as a matter of fact, and brought his family much heartache. But he also had very loving aunts and grandparents and, of course, parents. And he heard all these stories about neighbors, and they all informed his work. And you will find mention of certain events that stuck in his mind in various plays. There's a reference, for instance, one of the change is always a big part in Horton Foote's plays and how people deal with change
and keep that dignity when things are entirely upside down.
Right. And of course, we live in a world now where change is happening almost as fast as we can keep up with. But how people deal with change and retain their dignity and manage to come through the other side is always a key theme in it. And he used to one of the stories when he was young was when the first cotton picking machines came into being, which was going to put a lot of field hands, mostly black or Mexican in the south of Texas, out of work. And he makes reference to it in about three or four plays, as a matter of fact, about how, and he uses it as a metaphor for the changes that can happen and take away a person's livelihood or change the whole way life is lived. Later, of course, oil replaced cotton. Cotton went away in Texas as a major concern. At one point, the entire economy of the state depended on the cotton crop, basically. But that changed. Then it was whether there was going to be oil leases. And, for instance, in dividing the estate, there's one of the issues that comes up is whether this great plantation, which is now farms and once been a big cotton plantation, is going to be broken up or whether they were going to sell oil lease rights to try to get some money to keep the the farms and the estate going. But it's a metaphor that he used a lot. And as I say, change is a very key part to his characters and how he develops them and how they relate and how they react to the changes that take place.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Earlier there was mention of one of my favorite movies, Bruce Beresford's Breaker Moran. I was wondering if the guest had any insight into what Mr. Foote particularly liked about that movie, or the director.
Well, it's an interesting thing. He had not seen it until Bob Duvall told him to go see it. And they, as I say, they were looking for, tried to find a director for Tender Mercies. And it's an interesting story. He went and he liked the movie very much. He was very much taken with it. But he didn't quite understand how an Australian could really relate to small town life in Texas. And so, but they sent Beresford this, but he liked his work, and they sent Beresford the script. Beresford read it. He said he'd really like to do it. And so Beresford flew from Australia to New York, and he and Foote came down to Texas together, and they spent about nearly a week based in Dallas, but driving around from Waxahachie and small little towns all around in Dallas County and Tarrant counties. And Foote said every place we'd go, he'd say, "It's just like Australia. It's just like Australia." And it was a puzzle to Foote, but he, in conversations with him, realized that this man fully understood what the culture and the people of Texas were like, and he signed him immediately to be director for Tender Mercies.
People may not realize that Horton Foote initially intended to become an actor, and it was Agnes DeMille, who you mentioned earlier, who said, "I bet you would be a fantastic writer."
Right. Well, it's very interesting. They were both working for Foote was he wanted to be an actor. That was his great driving ambition, and he felt it was his calling. And he was studying with some Russians in New York. What was the advent of what became known as the method of acting here? And he was working with the American Actors Company, which was run by Mary Hunter, in preparation for a play he was going to be in. She was having the actors do some improvisations. And every member of the cast got up and were going to do an improv on life from their hometown. And Horton did three or four from Horton. And Agnes DeMille, who was working on another project with the American Actors Company, but they became very close friends, lifelong friends, as it turned out, he came and sat down next to her, and Agnes reached over and said, "Have you ever thought about writing?" And Horton just said, no. He'd never given it a thought, as a matter of fact. But it's very interesting. He went home that night. It stuck in his mind. And he wrote out a one-act play. It was his first play, based on one of the improvs he had done, which was called Horton Dance. And it was based on, it had 15 characters in it and a little one-act play that lasted about 20 minutes. And it was set at a dance, a weekly dance in Horton. And almost the entire town passes, is set just outside the dance, and the, almost the entire town goes in and out of the dance at some time. The young people who are going to the dance, one couple that are meeting in secret because their parents didn't approve. There's a local young widow who comes looking for an old boyfriend. A teacher comes by, and they all have to hide their beer from her because she's afraid. Anyway, it was a very success. Mary Hunter ended up staging it as an evening of one acts. And strangely enough, a critic from the New York Mirror, a paper that's long been since defunct, came and admired it very much. But it's very strange. Even after that success and a good review from a New York paper and what was then an off Broadway house, he still, for another year and a half, still wanted to be an actor, pursued acting. He didn't really think about writing again until a little over a year later.
Was he a good actor?
Well, it's hard to say. He was an adequate actor. He got parts. He was even in a part until his scene was cut in a play that was bound for Broadway. But in the end, he decided it was not his real calling.
My guest this hour is Wilborn Hampton. He is a theater critic for the New York Times and author of the biography Horton Foote, America's Storyteller. He's in town to speak tonight at Arts and Letters Live at 7:30 at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can find information at dallasmuseumofart.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times theater critic Wilborn Hampton. He is also the author of the 2009 biography Horton Foote, America's Storyteller. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to go back to this sort of emergence of Horton Foote, the writer, the playwright, because even the first full-length play that he wrote that was produced, Texas Town, he was still thinking, this is just a vehicle for me to be an actor.
Absolutely. He went home, actually, to Horton, and he went home specifically to write a play. He had been thinking, this was about a year or so after Horton Dance was done with the American Actors Theater, and he had still been thinking about it. He enjoyed the experience, and so he thought he was going for a visit home, and he saved up enough money, and he took a train down. And on the train, he kept thinking about what he was going to write about. He got there and he announced to his family, he said, I'm here to write a play. And so he spent all of his days working on what became Texas Town. It was his first full-length play. Took it back home to New York and showed it to Mary Hunter, who was the who ran the American Actors Company. She immediately wanted to do it, and he would star in it. He would be – it's a story about it has 22 characters in it. And the entire town, it takes place on the day that the governor of Texas is visiting the small town of Richmond, which later was renamed Harrison, but it was always a stand-in for Horton. Mm-hmm. And the governor, who's going to come, has the town split, totally divided. Some are for him, some are against him. It was based on, at the time, the singing governor of Texas, Pappy O'Daniel, and this governor also sang. But the whole town comes through the drugstore that day. Yeah, but the main story centers around a young man who wants to leave town, who wants to go out in the world, get to Houston, make his fame and his fortune, and his girlfriend, who whose mother wants her to marry the owner of the drugstore and stay in Wharton and secure her future by marrying money. But she loves the young man, Ray, who's the one that wants to leave and become an oil wildcatter. So Horton played the part of Ray, and it was done. And to the surprise of everyone, Brooks Atkinson, who was then the chief drama critic of the New York Times, came to see it. And even though it was what would be considered, as I say, an off-Broadway or even off-Broadway venue. And Brooks Atkinson wrote a rave review. It was done at a small little theater down in Greenwich Village on 16th Street. And he wrote his review, and he said how strange it is to come out of 16th Street and see, having felt that you revisited a town in small Texas where all of life passes you by. It was an absolute rave review. The only reservation that Brooks Atkinson had in his review was the performance of the lead male actor, Horton Foote. And at the party later, in those days, the theater critic went straight back from the theater to write his review on deadline. And so the papers came out at about 3 or 4 in the morning. Everybody was at a party, post, opening night party. And they got the papers and started reading the review, and Horton was just crushed. Everybody else was ecstatic. The New York Times had just given a rave review to a brand new play, and Horton had almost forgotten he was the author of it because he was so hurt and crushed by Atkinson's review of his performance. The actor was still in him at that time. But it was not long after that. He actually went from that. He still did one more summer of stock theater acting up in a resort up in upper New York. And it was during that summer that the desire to act left him almost as suddenly as it was visited upon him as a teenager. And he decided that he wanted to do nothing but write the rest of his life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next on the phones to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. When I was an undergraduate at Southern Methodist University, I was involved with a literary festival there, and I was lucky enough in 1986 to be his escort. For about a day and a half, 2 days, I, picked him up at the airport and took him to his hotel. This, I just wanted to underscore, and then I have a question. This was a truly sweet gentleman, one of the nicest human beings that God ever created. And my question related to that is, keep in mind, I was involved with the literary festival. What that means is I encountered other authors and playwrights, and his unpretentiousness about the way he dealt with students, and he spread his wisdom around freely in his time. He is just an impossibly nice human being, and I'm telling you, I encountered some really, really difficult people, really. And, of course, you know this. You're the New York Times theater critic. But speak to what he must have thought of the literary world, which he had such a giant reputation, surrounded by, the industry packed with pretentious people. I'm really curious about that. Thanks.
Well, you're right. You met the man. And I think it's one of the reasons actually that he is such a successful playwright. You couldn't say that he never met a man he didn't like. There were some people that he didn't like, but they were usually the hypocritic and self-important people who bloat themselves up, and he didn't care for that much. But he would never sort of express it to their face. He liked people. He liked hearing their stories. He loved stories. And he loved turning those stories then into dramas. People that he would meet, he always liked to know about them. He was a curious man. It was once said of John F. Kennedy that he wasn't interesting himself so much as he was interested. And it was certainly true of Horton Foote. Whether it was true of Jack Kennedy or not, I don't know, because I didn't really know the president. But I did know Horton, and he was interested in people, and it showed in his work. And that's one of the reasons that his plays ring so true, because he gets to the heart and the soul of all of his characters. And it's one of the reasons actors love to play in his work, in his either his movies or his teleplays or his stage plays, is that all of the characters. They may be drunkards. They may be reprobates. They might even be murderers. But there's always some redeeming quality to them. There's always some human element in their psyche that is on the printed page that they can turn into a living character and make believable. And that sense of redemption and of every, that there is a part of every human being that can be redeemed and can be made human. And it comes across in all of his plays and nearly all of his characters.
I was really struck in reading in the book the account of the young man from Atlanta for which he won a Pulitzer Prize, and the sensitivity in that case in which he took a story that had ties to something that happened within his own family, and he waited until the people who might have been hurt by seeing themselves portrayed on stage were gone.
Well, it's very true. Horton was more interested in friendship than he was in money. If he thought the play might be successful, I mean, there are many writers who would have gone ahead and written, you know, and the devil be damned.
Sell their firstborn and get on with it. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Horton didn't do that. There were a couple of plays that he kept in a drawer until he felt that the people who were involved had passed on. And this involved his real aunt, Aunt Lily, who was also the focus of a couple of the plays in the Orphan's Home Cycle, one of them named for Lily Dale. And it was a real life, the young man from Atlanta was a real life tragedy for her, and when her only son had apparently suicided by drowning in a lake in Florida. And it was true of a couple of other plays, but another one was The Day Emily Married, which is a late play which he had written earlier and kept in a drawer for like 20 years until all the people had gone on to their rewards, and then it was able to be shown. But it was also true. I won't go into the whole thing, but there is also a confusion over the stage rights to Kill a Mockingbird. Usually when it's done as a stage play, they use Horton's movie script. But the actual author of the play, the theater rights, stage rights, were given to another writer very early, and it was not a very successful adaptation. So most theaters, as I say, use Horton's screenplay. But on the playbills, it will usually list this other writer as the author instead of Horton. And Horton, of course, never got a dime from any of the stage royalties. And Michael Wilson, the director, was very close to Horton and a brilliant interpreter of his work at the Hartford Stage, was going to try to change that a couple of years ago, just before Horton died. And Horton wouldn't have it. He said friendship's more important than money. Mm-hmm. And he was not going to upset his lifelong friendship with Harper Lee just to earn a few dollars in royalties from the stage plays. It's interesting, the last caller gentleman talked about how Horton looked so kindly. It was Harper Lee who gave one of the best physical descriptions of Horton. She once said in an interview, Horton Foote, he looks like God, but clean-shaven.
The last clip that we have here, we'll play it in a minute, is from The Trip to Bountiful. And this, before we play this, and we'll play from the 1985 film, but what a long and interesting history this particular story had over the course of his career.
Well, it is. And the germ of the idea was that it had its origins back when he made a trip with his grandfather and visited a town that no longer existed. And he came back to it, and when he first started writing for television, his main producer was a man named Fred Coe, who ran the Philco Television Playhouse. And he went into Fred Coe and said, Fred Coe liked to read synopsis, and a one-page synopsis. Foote said, I can't write this down. He said, I just want to tell it to you. It was probably the forerunner of the Hollywood pitch, and it was about the only time that Foote made a Hollywood pitch. So Coe asked him in. He said, sit down. What's it about? And Horton said, well, this is a story about an old lady who wants to go home. There was a long pause. Coe said, that's it? Horton said, that's it. Coe looked at him for a while, and he said, okay, I trust you. And he went on, and he wrote it. And it began life as a teleplay for the Philco Television Playhouse. And it was so successful that Coe wanted to transfer it to Broadway, and it did the next year. But Broadway in those days, you had to have two intermissions, people to go out and get a drink at intermission or something. So they had to break the narration down, and it pretty much destroyed the flow of her bus trip back to Bountiful. And, of course, as we all know, when she gets there, Bountiful no longer exists, and it's another drama of change and an elegiac play. And so the stage production wasn't particularly good. It was like 20 years later that somebody came to him with the idea of doing it as a movie. And they asked him, if Lillian Gish wasn't around to play the role of Carrie Watts, who was his first choice? And without thinking, he said, without just hesitating, he said, Geraldine Page.
You know, my father was a good man in many ways. He's a peculiar man, but a good one. And one thing he never could stand was see a bird shot on his land. If he saw a man coming here hunting, he'd just go take his gun and chase him away. And I think the birds knew that they couldn't be touched here. Our land was always home to them. We had ducks, geese, finches, blue jays, bluebirds and redbirds.
The rice birds, being thicker every year. They seem to thrive out here on the coast.
I think a mockingbird's my favorite of all.
I think it's mine, too.
I don't know, though. I am mighty partial to the scissor tail.
That was Geraldine Page in The Trip to Bountiful, the 1985 adaptation of Horton Foote's play, teleplay and then play. My guest this hour is Wilborn Hampton. We just have less than a minute left, and I wonder if you have sort of an essential list of Horton Foote works that people ought to see.
Wow. Well, that would be...
Now there's 60-some plays.
It would be very hard. We have... talked about several of them. The movies, of course, would be adaptations, two adaptations and two originals. Obviously, the Trip to Bountiful and Ten of Mercies were the originals, and Mockingbird and Tomorrow would be. There's also the film version of the second play in the cycle of the Orphans Home cycle is a play called Convicts, which was made into a movie with James Earl Jones and Robert Duvall yet again, and it's absolutely brilliant. And it's set on a plantation around the turn of the 20th century. Other than that, any of them.
That's good. That makes it easier. Wilborn Hampton is a theater critic for the New York Times. His 2009 book is Horton Foote, America's Storyteller. He's in town to speak about the Texas playwright at the Dallas Museum of Arts Arts and Letters live event this evening. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.